Laudator Jesus Christus. This is Vatican Radio.
From the English News Desk, I'm Emer McCarthy. Cardinal John Patrick Foley, Grand Master of the Equestrian Order of the Holy Sepulchre of Jerusalem, led Thanksgiving celebrations in Rome this Thursday, with Mass in Santa Susanna, the National Church in the Eternal City for the United States of America. During his homily, Cardinal Foley noticed that every Eucharistic sacrifice is, of course, a thanksgiving, but that this is a very special day for the American people, uniting all creeds and political parties under the one banner. Cardinal Foley went on to say that the United States may be at war on two fronts, Iraq and Afghanistan, and in the midst of the greatest world economic crisis in at least 30 and perhaps even 70 years. But at the same time, Americans still have much for which to be grateful, such as their lives, their families, their faith, and many spiritual gifts, not one of which is more important, he noted, than the Mass. The Cardinal also touched on the theme of immigration in his homily, saying that in spite of America's alleged unpopularity, people still wish to come to the United States in great numbers. Indeed, he noted, with the exception of Native Americans, American Indians, all are the sons and daughters of immigrants. He noted that with the exception of the descendants of slaves, all Americans are the descendants of those who came to the United States seeking freedom and opportunity, not least of which, he noted, is freedom of religion. The Cardinal continued by noting that while not all prejudice has been dispelled and not all injustices righted, the nation has truly made great giant strides in carrying out the promises that all men would be blessed and all men would be free. Concluding his homily, the Cardinal, one of the longest-serving U.S. prelates at the Vatican, urged prayers for President Obama and the nation's leaders, that they may be given the wisdom and strength to lead the nation with courage and sound moral conviction, so that the rights of all, especially the weakest and most vulnerable members of American society, be protected. This year marks Cardinal Foley's silver jubilee as Archbishop. 25 years ago, the Philadelphia native arrived in Rome as Archbishop President of the then Pontifical Commission, later Council, for Social Communications. As the Council President, he was the longest-serving head of a curial dicastery. We sat down with Cardinal Foley to take a look back over the 25 years that he has spent here at the Vatican.
25 years ago, I was a priest of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, and I had two jobs. One was the editor of the Catholic newspaper for Philadelphia, and the other was as a professor of philosophy at our seminary. And also, I had the job of being press secretary for the U.S. bishops' meetings twice a year. And also, I had already been the press secretary, the English language press secretary, for the trip of Pope John Paul II through Ireland and the United States in 1979, and for the Synod of Bishops on the Family in 1980 here in Rome. So I guess I had a lot of different experiences, but I was very happy as a priest of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. It was wonderful. My first assignment, where I continued to go every Sunday, actually, after I was a professor at the seminary, was in a parish in suburban Philadelphia, which had about 6,200 members in the parish, with 95% of them at Mass every Sunday, and one-third of them at daily Mass every day in Lent. So I often said my first assignment as a priest was like going to heaven without the inconvenience of dying, because it was just marvelous. It was a lot of work, but it was so gratifying, so inspiring. And I continue to be inspired by those people and by that experience.
You're often termed quite affectionately by the faithful of America, and particularly by the faithful of this part of America, as the Philly boy. Is that a title that you wear happily?
I never heard that before, but I am from Philadelphia, and I'm very proud of Philadelphia, and I view it as the city which is the birthplace of religious liberty in the United States. And for that, I'm very attached to the city and to that wonderful historic spirit of the city and what it has meant for the United States and for the Church in the United States.
25 years on, of course, it is a very different United States and it is a very different Church in the United States. Benedict XVI spoke about this during his most recent trip to the United States, saying that Europe has a lot to learn about religion and state and the relationship between the two. What does Europe have to learn from the United States?
Well, the United States, of course, never had a state church. And we have freedom of religion and equal opportunities for the members of all religions. And I think that's very important, that the church is not subsidized, it's not sustained by the state, but on the other hand, it has liberty to work. So I think that means that we can't take anything for granted in the United States. We have to be, I guess you could say, almost entrepreneurial in our work in religion, in the sense that we're responsible for building the churches, we're responsible for building the schools and maintaining them. We don't get a cent from the state for any of those activities. So if we want to keep the faith strong, it's we, not just the priests or not just the sisters, but all the faithful who have to work to keep the faith strong. Now, is it as strong as it was when I was ordained a bishop or especially a priest 47 years ago? I don't think so. The practice of religion has declined, unfortunately. And that's due to many different factors: secularism, some scandals in the church, the regular, I guess you could say, spiritual sloth, but also the decline in Catholic educational institutions, in the sense that because the number of sisters has declined and the number of priests has declined, then the schools become more expensive to operate and it's more difficult to get the support to keep the schools going. And without those schools, without the education in the basic truths of the faith, you run the risk of having a diminution of religious practice and of religious fervor. But I see many hopeful signs in the United States. And the Pope himself saw those hopeful signs. First of all, freedom to work, the openness to immigrants, the vitality of the church from the many different sources of immigrants, the Hispanic, the Vietnamese, the Chinese, the Koreans. It's amazing to see the flourishing of the church in the United States as a result of these different groups. And the United States was always strong through new immigrants. You know, the Statue of Liberty has that inscription, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free." Well, in the United States, they can breathe free. There might be discrimination, there might be prejudice among certain groups about certain other groups, but that becomes gradually overcome. And I think that's a beautiful tribute to the United States, and it's also, I think, a wonderful tribute to the Catholic Church in the United States, which I call the most Catholic and the most American of churches. It's the most Catholic because it's truly universal. In the United States, we have all ethnic groups, all racial groups, all in one church, which is a model for the United States itself, and it's a model for the church in the world.
And from this most Catholic and most universal of churches, you were plucked.
I received a call from my Cardinal Archbishop, Cardinal Kroll, who said, "I have the nuncio on the line." I was in my office at the newspaper. He said, "I have the nuncio on the line, and he said that the Holy Father has in mind to make you the president of the Pontifical Commission for Social Communications at the Vatican." So I said, "I think I better come up." So I went up to his office, and the nuncio was still on the phone. And I said to the nuncio, I said, "You know, there are a lot of people in Rome who are better equipped than I am." He said, "Oh, si. I said, "There are certainly a lot of people in Rome who know Italian better than I do." And he said, si. And I said, "And I'm the only child of a widowed mother." He said, "Bring her with you." And I said, "Do I have a choice in any of this?" He said, "Not really." Well, I said, I took a promise of obedience to my archbishop, and whatever he tells me to do and whatever the Holy Father tells me to do, I will do. And the Cardinal Archbishop said to me, "By the way, you will be a bishop. By the way, you will be a bishop." So then over the weekend, he said, "By the way, you're an archbishop." So my classmates joked and said, "You should have held out longer." But I was ordained an archbishop in Philadelphia to come to Rome. So my work as a bishop has been exclusively here in Rome. You know, I do ceremonies in the United States on different occasions, but my work has been here in Rome, both with the Pontifical Commission and Council for Social Communications, and now with the Order of the Holy Sepulchre of Jerusalem.
But what a mission as a bishop. It's not only a mission to the Church in the United States, it was a universal mission in its truest sense. You were the head of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications. Looking back at the 23 years, if I'm not mistaken, it was 23 years you were at the helm of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications. What would you have seen as have been the biggest initial challenges you had coming into the job?
Well, of course, the biggest initial challenge coming in is the fact that I wasn't really fluent in Italian. I had to learn on the job. It's bad enough to take part in a meeting when you don't know what's going on, but when you're running a meeting and don't know what's going on, that can be disastrous. But people were very kind and supportive and cooperative. And I think that among the things we were able to do, we were the first department to become computerized. We were able to get the internet top-level domain for the Vatican, a .va. They wanted to make us either .it for Italy or .org for organization, but I was able to fight that and get .va. And that's important because we have the assurance that everything that goes out from the .va top-level domain is authentic. And I think people have a right to that guarantee of authenticity. Also, among the things that seem to go over well around the world were our documents on ethics in advertising, in communications generally, and in internet. They were very well received, not only by Catholics around the world, but by other groups. And I still get invitations to speak to advertising groups or to communications education groups around the world about ethics in communications, ethics in advertising, ethics in internet. And I think that's a good indication of a preoccupation that many in the world have about having responsible media. And that is very gratifying to see that there exists this preoccupation. And also it's very gratifying to see that they turn to the Catholic Church for some guidance in this area. Also, we had prepared a pastoral instruction on the use of the media by the church. And Aetatis Novae, we called it, at the dawn of a new era. We issued it at the beginning of the 90s, and it was in view of the collapse of communism, in view of the coming of the third millennium. And we thought that was a good time to update what had been done by the Second Vatican Council and by the pastoral instruction which immediately followed that. By the way, I was present during the Second Vatican Council here in Rome as a student priest, working as a correspondent for our Catholic newspaper in Philadelphia. So I was in the Basilica when they had the proclamation of the decree on communications, Inter Mirifica, and it was ironic, I guess, that I should have been the director of the office, which was instituted as a result of that decree of the Second Vatican Council. So in a way, I've been here for the whole history, you might say, of the church's direct addressing of the communications media. And that's been for me a great consolation and an inspiration. My only regret is, as in all human activity, I couldn't do more. And there couldn't have been greater effectiveness of the church in all areas of communication around the world. But each one of us does what he or she can. And it's with the grace of God, we hope that something is built that will make a continuing contribution to people's faith and to their zeal. And we hope to their mutual love.
Particularly with English speakers, you have been known as the voice of the Vatican. You have dedicated most, if not nearly all, of your priestly mission to being a communicator. A lot of debate has been given over the years regarding the Vatican and communication. How can we reconcile the world of media, the demands of the mass media, modern media, and of course the Church's need to carry out its mission without having to pander to the demands of mass media?
Well, I think that what the media ask may sometimes be, let's say, inconvenient, but the opportunities they offer are irreplaceable. So either you respond to that moment, to that question at that moment, or you lose the opportunity. So I think we have to take advantage of the opportunities that are offered, even when they seem to be aggressive, to respond in a manner that is informative and can cast more light than heat on a particular question. So I think we should be as open as possible at all times with the media. And I think you have to deal with the media sometimes with a good sense of humor, too. I remember one time early in my years here, I was interviewed by the BBC. And this man with a Cockney accent, which was very unusual for the BBC, said, "Archbishop Foley, if Jesus himself came to the Vatican today, would the Swiss guards and the Vatican police let him in?" So I said, "Jesus is already here in the Blessed Sacrament. Jesus is already here in the church which he established. But if he were to arrive, as I think you're suggesting, I'm sure the Swiss guards and the Vatican police would welcome him. But I think they would have reservations about certain broadcasters." So I was later homesick in bed and listening to the BBC World Service, and I heard this particular interview on the radio, and at the end, the interviewer said, "As you can see, Archbishop Foley gave as good as he got," he said. So I thought, we need this sometimes, depending on the particular culture in the area, to respond in a way which can have substance, but at the same time have humor. Because we should take our message seriously, but never ourselves. So I think that it's very important to be responsive to the media and to encourage them in their work. It's under tremendous pressure that they do their work. And also they're expected to present complicated issues in a very simple manner, and we should help them to do that and not make life more difficult for them. I always thought that it would be a good idea, and I still think this after 25 years, that every document that we issue should be accompanied by a press release, not a summary, but a press release, what we consider to be the most important thing. Somebody in the Vatican once said to me, "Well, if the Pope issues it, what right do we have to say what is more important?" Well, I said, somebody else is going to determine what's more important, so we should do the determination and issue press releases indicating what we think are the most important parts of these documents. And then that helps them do their job. That has been a hard sell for me here at the Vatican, but I think it's important for the world to be able to get the message of Jesus Christ and the Church in an intelligible manner, as quickly as possible and as understandably as possible.
Now, you were at the helm, still at the helm of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications when you received good news yourself, and news that was greeted throughout the world and particularly back home in Philadelphia with tremendous joy. When did you find out you were going to become cardinal? And can you talk to us about that day, which was another milestone in your 25 years as Archbishop?
Well, when I was called in to be told that I was being made pro-Grandmaster of the Order of the Holy Sepulchre of Jerusalem, the Cardinal Secretary of State told me that the Pope is calling you pro-Grandmaster because he wants to make you a cardinal in the next consistory, which was very nice of him. I was very grateful for that. And first of all, he said, "What do you think about becoming pro-Grandmaster?" I said, "Well, I took a promise of obedience. Whatever the Holy Father wants, for me, that's the will of God. And I mean that." He said, "Not everybody thinks that way." I said, "Well, that's a shame that they don't, because I think that way." And so I was called right before the announcement by the Secretary of State's office. I was getting a cataract operation for my eye, and I was in the recovery room. And I had to go to see the Secretary of State almost immediately, and I went in looking like a pirate, you know, with a big patch over my eye. And the name Foley means pirate, robber, plunderer, thief. But so I went in to see him, and he told me that the Holy Father was announcing that I would be a cardinal, and the announcement would be the next day, a Wednesday, at the general audience. So I had to go back to the hospital for a checkup on my eye, and as I was being driven back to the Vatican, I said to the driver, could you leave me off at St. Peter's Square? There's an announcement being made today that I would like to hear. So I went into the square, and it was packed. There were about 30,000 people there for the Pope's audience that day. And I went to the back, and I was leaning on a barricade because I was tired after all this surgical work, you know. And I was right next to a man from Poland who spoke some English. And when he heard the Pope begin to read this list of names, he said, what's the Pope doing now? And I said, he's reading the list of new cardinals. He said, do you know any of them? I said, I know almost all of them, and I am one of them. Well, he looked at me as if I were crazy and just walked away. You know, what's this person doing in the back of St. Peter's Square with a big eye patch and looking as if he had just been run over by a truck? And he says he's a cardinal. So that was my memory of that particular day. And then I was, on the day I was named a cardinal, actually, my health wasn't particularly good, I remember. And I prayed that I just might be able to get through the day without collapsing. And God has been very good. So, and I've been able to, well, not only get through that day, but been able to travel around the world in my present job with various ceremonies. And thank God I've been enjoying better health since then. So God has been very good to me, and the Holy Father has been very good. I've known him, of course, since before I arrived in Rome 25 years ago. But I got to know him better through working in the Curia with him, and he's just an outstanding individual, a marvelous judgment. I was delighted when he was elected Pope, and it was a privilege to be able to be serving as a television commentator at that time for the funeral of Pope John Paul and for the election of Pope Benedict XVI. So, and a number of people have asked me, what was your most moving memory in doing all of the commentary over the years? And I have to say that it would probably have been the commentary for the final Way of the Cross of Pope John Paul II. He was in his private chapel, and it was the first time he was not able to go to the Colosseum for the Way of the Cross. And he was in his private chapel watching it on television. But there was a camera behind him, and he couldn't see it when they would take the pictures of him looking at television. But he didn't even know that they were doing that. They had a special feed to his television set of just the images from the Colosseum. And when they said the 12th station, Jesus dies on the cross, the Pope had a crucifix on his knee, and he embraced the cross at that moment. And there he was, a man just stricken with pain and with illness, and the fact that he would literally embrace the cross of Jesus Christ at that moment when the crucifixion was announced, almost moved me to tears, because I had to keep going on television, you know, but I was deeply moved at that moment. And I thought, this is remarkable, that this man who has done so much for the church, with the collapse of communism, with the wonderful pastoral visits around the world, now he is showing the church how to suffer, people in the church, how to suffer, and eventually how to die. And he's doing it in union with the cross of Christ. And I thought, what a beautiful lesson he's giving to the whole world.
Of course, we got onto this conversation speaking about your sub-career, if we can call it, because you've had so many. And of course, your main purpose over many years has been that to lead first the Council for Social Communications now, and just as importantly, if not more so in this current time, the Inquestion Order of the Holy Sepulchre of Jerusalem. But your sub-job, your TV commentaries, you're saying that this will be the first year TV viewers and radio listeners will not hear the tones of the Philly Boy for the Christmas Mass and the Urbi et Orbi message.
I guess I'm truly the ghost of Christmas past now. And for 25 years I did it. And it was at the invitation of the American TV network NBC, which in those days had a religious section. And they asked me to do the commentary when I came over here to be the president of the Pontifical Commission and later Council for Social Communications. So And at that time, there was regular religious programming on American television. The only religious program on American television now, on American regular channels, you might say, is the Pope's Midnight Mass at Christmas, carried by NBC. So I did that for 25 years, and I thought, well, 25 years is a good time to round it out and say, you know, it's better to be able to walk away than be carried away from the job. And I thought that it was important that there be a transition made at that time. But I used to do not only that commentary for Christmas, I also did the Christmas blessing and also the Way of the Cross and the Easter Mass and blessing of the Pope, even though they weren't carried on major networks in the United States, but they were carried on religious networks, and they were carried around the world on different networks. So the Philippines regularly replayed the Christmas Midnight Mass and the other masses from the Vatican, and Australia. I was just there, and people said, oh, we've heard you for many years. And it's amazing the size of the audience that those liturgical events had. But that's very important. It's a way of evangelizing, but I think it's also a way of bringing home to Catholics the message of the Pope himself in his own words. So he's not mediated through the media in that sense. He comes directly. What he says reaches people directly. And I always thought that was a great privilege, to be able to be the translator, not the interpreter, but the translator of what the Pope is saying, and that people were able to receive that directly from the Holy Father himself.
Do you have any one particular memory from those many, many years of Christmas night in St. Peter's Basilica?
I guess my first Christmas was so important because my mother was here at that time, and I was able to get her a good seat for the Christmas Midnight Mass. And the Pope, John Paul II, in coming up in his procession, went over and greeted and blessed my mother as he was in his procession up to the altar. So you can imagine what a relatively young archbishop, I was 49 at the time, I guess, thought about how wonderful it was that he could provide this opportunity for his mother to receive the special blessing of the Pope on Christmas Day. What a wonderful Christmas gift for her and for me.
Today, 25 years after your ordination as archbishop, you are now cardinal. You're no longer in the field of social communications for the church, but in one that perhaps is of even more and increasing importance for the universal church today. You are the Grand Master of the Equestrian Order of the Holy Sepulchre of Jerusalem.
Well, it's wonderful to be able to go back to where it all began. It all began in the Holy Land with the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior. So we have the responsibility as an order of making sure that what we call the living stones of the church in the Holy Land endure, not just the places, the churches, which have been constructed to recall the presence of Jesus at various stages of his life, death and resurrection, but also we have the responsibility of trying to maintain a living Christian community in those areas. So that's a great privilege, to be able to return to roots. And it's a continuing inspiration to go back to the Holy Land. I remember the first time I was there in the 1960s when I was a student priest here in Rome, and how I felt seeing the Sea of Galilee for the first time and walking the streets of Jerusalem. And now, of course, going back in my present job, realizing that in a way I'm partially responsible for helping these Christians in the Holy Land to remain, to be a vital Christian community. And that's extremely important for me. And to be an instrument of peace and reconciliation and love in the Holy Land. The various leaders in the Holy Land, the King of Jordan, the Prime Minister of Israel and the President of the Palestinian Authority all told me that the Catholic schools in the Holy Land, which are open to all, all Christians, whether Orthodox or Catholic, and also open to Muslims or also open to Jews, they said that these schools make a real difference also for the future, for peace, because they teach tolerance and understanding, and we hope eventually mutual love. But so it gives an opportunity to be an instrument of peace in a land that really needs peace.
The actual day you were telling me earlier, the actual day of your Silver Jubilee anniversary, you were in the Holy Land, the Middle East, in Jordan, doing something quite special, really.
They have indeed. It was the day that we welcomed the Holy Father to Amman, Jordan. And we accompanied him to the nunciature afterward. And he said, "Isn't this a special day for you?" I said, "Yes, Holy Father, it's the 25th anniversary of my ordination as an archbishop." So he led the congratulations of the people there, which was very nice. He had already sent a beautiful letter to me for that occasion. And he recalled that it was a special day for me, and then sort of a mini celebration there. And of course, I wasn't able to have anything here in Rome at the time, but a number of friends said, "You have to mark this anniversary in some way because you've been 25 years here." So I thought, all right. So the day before we had the, what we call the Grand Magisterium, that sounds terribly formidable, but it's the meeting of the leadership of the Order of the Holy Sepulchre. The day before that meeting here in Rome, and the day after my 74th birthday, I had a mass in St. Peter's at the altar of the chair to mark the 25th anniversary of my ordination as a bishop and to be able to give thanks to God and to the people here who have meant so much to me over the years. And a lot of people took part, which was very beautiful, and very encouraging and very consoling to me. And I'm very grateful to God for all of the experiences I've had from my birth. I had a wonderful family, a wonderful education, and I always say I've never had an unhappy day as a priest, and I've had the privilege of teaching seminarians, and I've had the privilege of being a communicator, and the privilege of working closely with two Holy Fathers. So it's been, my life has been really an inspiration.
You're listening to Vatican Radio.